You are listening to the
World Extreme Medicine Podcast.
Welcome back to the podcast with myself, Wayne Walker. In this episode, we're going to be speaking with Luca Carenzo on exercise-associated collapse. So what I wanted to do in the conversation is explore some of the nuances and challenges of exercise-associated collapse, and also look at a recent publication in the Journal of Science and Medicine in Sport of an unusual case of marathon-related exercise-associated collapse. So this publication was a case-based report with some considerations for medical care at endurance mass participation events. So we're going to explore the case itself, written up by Luca. We're also going to dig into some of the empirically proven treatments that form the mainstay of treatments within exercise-associated collapse. We're also going to visit some of the reflections on the case and how it's changed Luca's thinking on the list of differentials within exercise-associated collapse. So to do this, I have Luca Carenzo with me. Luca is an anaesthetic and critical care consultant from Milan, Italy. He previously worked at the Royal London Hospital, Adult Critical Care Unit, and also London HEMS, and has taken part in some mission work with Doctors Without Borders. He's also a World Extreme Medicine faculty member, and he currently works at the Instituto Clinico Humanitas, which is a department of anaesthesia and intensive care medicine in Milan. So he also, if that wasn't enough, works as a consultant for iHelp, which is an Italian critical care company designed to cater to mass events. Luca, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much for having me over. It's a real pleasure.
I wondered, firstly, if you could get you to speak to some of the generic challenges of exercise-associated collapse.
Yeah, so actually, exercise-associated collapse is the most common cause of collapse in endurance athletes. But the key aspect of this specific pathology, because the first key point of endurance running in general, is that we do have some specific pathologies that clinicians wanting to work in such events need to be aware of, is that exercise-associated collapse is an event likely due to postural hypotension happening usually at the end of the race. So the most common event endurance athletes face, but it's the cause of collapse at the end of the race. So the first thing to remember is if somebody is collapsing or fainting during the race, then always think something else. So that is a collapse that is still exercise associated, but is not what we usually mean by exercise associated collapse. So that's one of the key points. The second thing is exercise associated collapse influences the structure, not only your medicine, but also the structure of how you deploy your medical care on site. Finish line, I think most of us can think of a finish line of a running event. For instance, if you think where medals are given, that's usually a few hundred meters from the finish line, and that has a medical reason. We want to keep people walking. We want to keep people walking because if they suddenly stop, then their venous return decrease, and then they actually have a more symptomatic hypotension, and we have a higher chance of actually having collapse at the finish line. So the first key public health intervention is finish line. People need to keep walking and away from the finish line.
Could you speak to the case in question? So this was a 61-year-old patient. Could you speak to what the circumstances were and indeed just unpack the case?
Yeah, so as you correctly said, when you presented the paper, this is, we entitled the paper, an unusual case of exercise-associated collapse, because what we did was we did a bit of a workup and we couldn't really find anything from what we consider a classic exercise-associated collapse. So basically, we are in 2022 on April the 3rd. We are in Milan, Milan City Marathon, which is a World Athletics labeled marathon. And it was 1:48, I think, p.m. And a 61-year-old experienced endurance running, and this has a role also because the experience of the runner might actually change their susceptibility to actually suffering certain injuries or illnesses. So he was approaching the very end of the of the marathon, and basically a few meters, he actually sort of lost consciousness. I have to add that it was a fairly mild day, and the absolute temperature was, the dry temperature was 11 degrees. And I say the dry temperature because we often, in running, in endurance medicine, we tend to use the wet bulb globe temperature, which is a temperature corrected for humidity and radiation. This is very important. So what happens is, I was in the advanced medical post, providing as a sort of critical care physician on standby. But on the finish line, you have walking teams, first aiders. And, you know, different countries will have different systems, different professional profiles. But we have walking teams, mostly of what could be an emergency, advanced medical emergency technicians. So we do not have paramedics. But these were like either basic or advanced EMTs. So they were equipped with resuscitation equipment, AED, and everything to do a BLS. They approached him, and what happened is he was found sort of unconscious and gasping. And you know, for a basic technician, unconscious and gasping equals to a cardiac arrest. So what gets started is chest compressions and the AED is attached. No shock is advised. So because we are in a very open space, very subject also to public exposure, media exposure, and because there is an advanced medical post, he then gets loaded onto a trolley. We have military trolley, which the main characteristic is large wheels, makes it easier to go on rough terrains, and get wheeled in into the advanced medical post. We actually get alerted with a cardiac arrest call. So what we are expecting is actually a cardiac arrest. But in fact, when he gets to the advanced medical tent, he has a significant self-abdominal, he's breathing by himself, very deep abdominal breathing. He's fully unconscious. His pupils are quite enlarged, but his pulse, carotid pulse, is quite unremarkable. So he's definitely not in cardiac arrest. He's actually quite hypertensive at the first monitoring, but he's fully flaccid. So quite a lot of different conflicting information for us to elaborate at the time. So I think what we do is we quickly assess a few vitals, which are fundamental in endurance medicine. And among others, of all, we do multiparametric monitoring, but we especially care about body temperature and also serum sodium. Body temperature, because decreased loss of consciousness and hyperthermia is a hallmark of exercise-associated heat stroke, which is a medical emergency, and changes in serum sodium, especially hyponatremia associated with sport, can be a sign of exercise-associated hyponatremia, which is a very specific form of hyponatremia that, differently from what we've taught in medical school, is an hyponatremia that requires a fast corrections, because we usually have thought sodium needs to be corrected slowly. So this is sort of the pre-hospital, the very first few minutes diagnostics. So he is not hyperthermic, he's normothermic. And so we don't give an indication to go with what we call the heat deck. And that's another, I think, we can later talk a bit about this. It's, again, goes back to structural and how we actually plan our response when we are in such events. Heat strokes are common in endurance and running medicine, and as such, we need to have facilities to rapidly cool athletes, because time is brain, as we say in other time-sensitive pathologies, time is brain in heat stroke as well. So any guideline you'll find will say cool first and then transport later.
How important is it, Luca, to really rule out other etiologies, other pathologies, before you get to a formative diagnosis? And what pathologies are you looking at? So you just mentioned some of the more classic cases of hyponatremia. Could you speak to what you're thinking in your mind to rule out first and foremost before you get to more of an atypical presentation?
Absolutely. So first of all, again, I'll go back to the title of the case, exercise-associated collapse. First of all, we need to be at the likely we need to be at the finish line, and it's also an exclusion diagnosis. What do I mean? That especially if this happens on the course, I first want to be sure it's not something we would say more life-threatening. And then if our listeners will read the case and we will unveil a bit of it, they will see this is more of a medical case, but there is a minimum standard that we need to guarantee on the field before we send the patient to the hospital for further investigations, because there are a few conditions that we need to treat on site. And that these conditions are, okay, of course, cardiac arrest. So first thing I think is collapsed athlete. I will need to check the pulse. And this approach doesn't differ in the running setting. Now, we exclude cardiac arrest. We have the typical endurance run, pathologies, heat stroke, exertional heat stroke, because we have classic heat stroke and exertional heat stroke. And one of the things to remember about exertional heat stroke is that exertional heat stroke does not necessarily happen in the heat, okay? So the temperature is air temperature is very important, because it increases the risk, it's a risk factor, and you will find tables, graded, color-graded tables using the wet bulb temperature, which goes from green to yellow to red to black, saying, okay, if the temperature today is 25, that's already a red. That means there is a high risk of exertional heat stroke in your population. But that does not mean necessarily that a low temperature and a susceptible athlete will not have an heat stroke just because it's cold outside. So that's always think heat stroke. What do guidelines say? Rectal temperature. So you need to have thermometer. Usually we use digital thermometer with a long soft probe that can stay in place also during cooling, because you need to monitor the athlete temperature during cooling. Now, how do we do cooling? There are different ways, and you will find in the literature comparison of different cooling methods. But today, the gold standard is cold water immersion. And I would say also ice cold water immersion. So there are big, we usually use small inflatable, let's say pools, which are actually designed for this used, or you can use slightly larger plastic boxes, which are full of water and ice. We keep the temperature low. Some studies have been done with 4 degrees water. Now, on a practical perspective, when we're on the field, we don't really have a way of keeping the water at a constant temperature, but that's fine as long as you have ice. And then you have a lot of non-technical skills, because imagine you're actually submerging an unconscious patient in ice water, and you need to make sure you don't drown it yourself. So it requires a bit of an experienced team and you to submerge him, while of course somebody is checking on the vitals and somebody is keeping their head out of the water. If you look online, you can find some videos also of easier methods, like there is a method called the TACO method, but it's not really feasible for advanced medical post, but it's good if you're running with friends and you have access to ice. Just take like a tarp, plastic tarp, put the person in the tarp and throw ice from ice packs in the tarp with the person, and actually just roll it like a taco. But you can, this is a bit, a bit rougher, especially if you're like on the asphalt of the area where you have your advanced medical post. Body immersion, way more effective than any water spraying. And this has been tested sort of in a laboratory-based publications. Then the second thing I would, and I need to cool, as I said, I need to cool before transporting. So transporting a hyperthermic patient with a decreased state of consciousness, these are the two hallmarks of exercise-related heat stroke, is suboptimal care, is not gold standard. Second thing is exercise-associated hyponatremia. So any marathon medicine guidelines will now recommend for any event the availability of a portable point of care device to measure serum sodium. And for most people, that means usually using a portable point of care acid-based gas ABG cartridge that will not only do serum sodium, but will do a few other things like pH, potassium as well, depending on the producer, but they're portable machines. Now, this is, I think, what we could say the most lethal triad. These are the three pathologies that have the highest morbidity. But there are a few other things that need to be excluded. And these are, of course, glucose disturbances, but that's fairly, you could either have it in your ABG panel or with just a dextrose stick, need to make sure you don't have a hypoglycemia. And temperature, when you're measuring temperature for hyperthermia, you're also excluding hypothermia, because that can happen as well. Hypothermia and shivering. Shivering also increases your metabolism, increases your lactate. And then you have more medical pathologies, so exclude chest pain, exclude causes of myocardial infarction or other causes that can cause syncope. But then, you know, those require expedite hospitalizations, not really necessarily a treatment on site. So I would say this is what I would want to exclude before actually loading the patient and sending him to an ambulance, sending him to a hospital.
So Luca, this wasn't a case of refractory VF, but if it was, what would you want on site if that was the case? Would you want extracorporeal life support available?
Well, you know, there's extracorporeal life support, or ECLS, is a very interesting topic nowadays. There is a lot of debate on its utility in pre-hospital, in out-of-hospital cardiac arrest care. And definitely it's something that we have considered and that we have available, for instance, in Milan. And the reason is there is, of course, cost-benefit analysis to be made, but larger events where there is a higher risk of cardiac arrest could probably benefit from having, I'd say, either, you know, the ability of doing extracorporeal life support on site, or at least for the medical organizers, a clear fast track to an ECMO center in case of a cardiac arrest. And that's something you need to discuss in advance with your pre-hospital system, your city pre-hospital system, and with your own ECMO centers. So as you might be aware, for instance, in Paris, there is an ECMO team which goes out for out-of-hospital cardiac arrest, has a routine. Like, we do not have that. We do have an in-hospital ECMO network for cardiac arrest, where a patient gets taken preferentially to ECMO centers, viable cardiac arrests. And because we do have this network in the city of Milan, what we do is we actually take an ECMO team for the day out in the advanced medical post. So what we do is we have them come with their own equipment. We dedicate a tent of the advanced medical post, which is usually a smaller tent, but it's sort of a protected sterile cockpit area where we can perform percutaneous cannulation with a consultant intensivist and a perfusionist. Does it have a associated cost? Definitely. Our personal experience actually comes from a cardiac arrest we had more than 10 years ago, where a patient went into cardiac arrest at the finish line. It was actually transferred to an ECMO center and cannulated on site, and unfortunately later died. And so we had some discussions on whether we could do this directly on site. Actually, for those of you which will be interested in reading the paper, if you go to the references, reference number one actually is the case report of this cardiac arrest we had with subsequent in-hospital cannulation and later death.
We'll put the paper in the show notes so people can look up that reference and look at that case study, actually, because I think it would be hugely informative. As you said, there's a lot of ongoing work as to where ECLS sits, actually. Does it sit pre-hospital? Does it sit in hospital? And the trend at the moment in the UK and in certain parts of Europe seems to be specialist centres, like you said, because actually the window of opportunity is narrow pre-hospital. And actually, if you can get these patients intra-arrest, well-ventilated to preserve their organ function to a specialist team in a specialist hospital that do this routinely, it seems to be that seems to be the way it's going. And so it's no surprise that that's the way it happens in Milan. But we'll add the paper in the show notes, because it is fascinating to see where ECLS is going. Could you maybe speak to what you found from this 61-year-old male, both neurologically, from an endocrine perspective, and indeed from a cardiac perspective?
Yeah, so I will quickly go back to the advanced medical post. So he was in a persistent coma. So what we did is we deliver a pre-hospital anesthetic and we send him to the emergency department. We were actually lucky to take him to my own hospital, because I have a hospital-based job mainly. And this was destination assigned by the dispatch center in our own pre-hospital system, because in our system is a centralized dispatch center which not only dispatches primary ambulances but also decides the best hospital for the patient based on hospital availability and patient characteristics. So now we are here. We basically arrive to the hospital after what we would say a blue call patient, and I think what things are into the mind of a clinician. Well, patient had a collapse, was unconscious, has been intubated. I want to exclude, any cardiac acute event. Of course, I haven't mentioned we did a 12 lead ZKG on site, which was substantially negative, definitely had no ST elevation or ST depression. So basics that you would do in your own emergency department were repeated, so a 12 lead EKG was repeated. And then we have a choice of diagnostics. And what happens in our specific case is that because we had pre-alerted the hospital, we already had a cardiologist in the A&E, which then immediately checks the heart with an echo. And I have discussion with colleagues which ask me, like, he was unconscious by the time, he was very hemodynamically stable, but he had a slightly anisocoria, so the pupils were slightly different in size. So why you didn't go straight to CT? And actually, we go to CT shortly after, but we already had a cardiologist with the machine on site, and which did a focus point of care, which only took a few minutes. And then I have no right or wrong answer to this point, because he didn't have a blown up pupil, which then I would have pushed for the CT immediately. He just had a mild anisocoria with reactive pupils. So we took the time to do a quick echo, and the ventricular function, the heart function was actually fine. And then we went to CT. Did basal CT, and also we did an angio CT, because we could not exclude that, of course, he had a stroke. Patient is unconscious now and with pupillary changes, so we felt it would actually exclude that we were not missing anything from the patient. Meanwhile, some blood tests get sent among the others, and this is worth mentioning. Most, emergency department like ours works on baseline panels depending on the pathology. And so we also measure troponin I, which is usually often elevated in endurance patient. And troponin alone are not a marker of myocardial, they are somehow marker of myocardial damage, but not in the way we usually thinking of myocardial necrosis and infarction. So If you don't have any ECG changes and you have an troponin elevation, you need to have some other studies to actually make sure the patient has not an ischemic problem. And the echocardiogram is the first level, because performed usually by a cardiologist, because you really need regional motion. You need to check for regional motion and not just the global functioning of the heart. Then we go to CT, and so the neuroradiologist reporting the CT. The CT is unremarkable, the angio is unremarkable, except for some hyperdense signal in the pituitary area, and which is suspected for a pituitary bleeding, which is, I mean, a bit unusual. You know, we are like all a bit, I would say, fascinated by this, because it's a very unusual finding. So the patient then gets sent to ICU. We perform also an EEG, an electroencephalogram, just to make sure that, again, to exclude, again, in our differentials, what are we thinking now? Non-convulsant status epilepticus. We want to make sure patient is not in non-convulsant status epilepticus. And then EEG comes back normal. So overnight, the patient is, sedation is weaned, and he's promptly extubated.
To that point, Luca, patient's extubated. What? So my question is going to be, you know, from a holistic perspective, how important is it to do a full panel of bloods, to do a neurological, an endocrine scan, or an endocrinological scan, and a full cardiac scan as well, both an echo and repeat ECGs and troponins post return. But I guess, in a sense, I want to jump to what the diagnosis was. But then I really do want to look at how important it is, certainly to look at the endocrine footprint of a patient, because I think here it was really quite key that you both looked at the endocrine function of the patient, as well as what would routinely be a full cardiac panel, such as the ECG, such as the POCUS, and then a neuro scan. Could you maybe speak to, firstly, what was the diagnosis of the patient, and then secondly, why is it prudent to look at the endocrine footprint of a patient?
Well, in this case, the endocrine studies, which were later performed, they were not performed in the emergency department. So I shall actually say that this is an interesting case, because I had the honor of actually wearing two hats, because I had the hat of the pre-hospital physician, and then the hat of the, you know, intensivist later on, which allowed me to follow up on a lot of interesting investigations, is that we had anatomical damage to the key area in the brain that is responsible for producing all the signaling hormones that cause the release of hormones in the human body. And pituitary bleeding, it's a fairly rare occurrence, but it can be a catastrophic one, because if you lose the signaling that stimulates your adrenal gland to release cortisol in your body, then you'd have like profound hypotension, profound vasoplegic shock. And this was not the case. This was not the case. But pituitary bleeding can be quite clinically devastating. The colleague that actually was receiving the patient in A&E, because when we brought it in, I was still as a pre-hospital physician, thought it was prudent to administer 100 milligrams of hydrocortisone as a therapy. But then later on, the endocrinologist was involved over the following day. They've requested sort of a standard bloods, first level bloods for cortisol, thyroid, as well as testosterone and IGF-1, insulin growth factor 1. They all were in normal limits, and he was doing well. So it was actually concluded that he had no acute pituitary dysfunction, although he was also booked for outpatient ACTH stimulation test, which is a dynamic test. It's something that you give a substance and then you measure the response. And I think, without going into the details of every single aspect, what we highlighted with this case is that often
you know, specialists tend to focus only on their area of interest, but sometimes patients are a bit more complex than that. And I'm not talking necessarily about emergency care, because the second half of this case report is all ambulatory based and, you know, super specialist consultation. Also because, you know, the endocrine panel wasn't really seemed to be justifying the entirety of the what had happened. And also because we ended up downloading the AED data that was connected by the EMTs, because I think that's a good clinical practice, and it's also a standard of care in, let's say, our EMS system. Anytime we connect an AED to a patient, then the team has to download and submit the dump of the AED to the local EMS system. This has been discussed with the then hospital cardiologist, and then the patient was booked for second level testing. Although you remember that echo was normal acutely, he was booked for a cardio CT. A cardio CT is an exam which we see performed more and more, because it's a non-invasive way of showing the amount of calcium and plaques you may have in your coronary. And he had a previous negative stress test. So functionally, under stress, he was fine. But with the cardio CT, we found that his coronaries were actually quite diseased, to the point that he was given an indication for an elective angiogram, so taken to the cath lab subsequently. And he received actually stenting of two coronaries, which is something that we would have not been able to find out only with first level investigations. Now, I'm not going to enter, I've discussed this with cardiologists, I'm not going to enter into all the nuances that are in whether you're going to indicate, you know, elective stenting for or versus medical therapy, because that's a whole different world. But I'll just present what happened to our patient.
So just looking at this case in general, fascinating case, because like you said, it's very occult, so it's quite hidden and uncertain as to what the collapse was initially. He had a full screen, but interestingly, you know, the symbiosis of good pre-hospital care, so AED on promptly, good airway management, hopefully oxygen, temperature, full workup pre-hospitally. And as you said, it's not to be taken lightly that actually you should front load critical care services at the end of a race, because fundamentally that's when patients are physiologically at their most fragile or vulnerable. So it's prudent to have the majority of care there. But to your point, Luca, about having that symbiosis of good sequential care across the platform, so, and good retrospective data, so downloading the defib, speaking with the crews, getting a good handover from the crews about exactly what the, I mean, you know, you were there in the essence, or your colleagues were there initially, and it's having that good handover of care, because when you're receiving a patient, you want to know the exact details of that collapse. So there's good robust pre-hospital care, there's good handover of that robust care, then there's systematic and thorough examination, including an endocrine panel further down the line, and a CT, a cardiac CT, to exclude the diagnosis. But I think what I'm notioning at is this robust sequential care across different trajectories of care, so pre-hospital, in hospital, and then even further within the medics, and looking at the ongoing care within cardiology and indeed endocrinology, but pulling the learning out of each. So like you say, going back to the defib, going back to the endocrinologist and seeing what the panel was, and having a watchful eye over all parts, and also making sure that the story that the patient handover in each part of that is transferred not only exactly and appropriately, but clearly and concisely, so that there's no detail missing across that platform. And I think this case notions to that there was good sequential care and that there was good passage of information across, so you could start to exclude to the point where you could get to a robust, definitive diagnosis.
And to go back to where we started, I think this is also interesting for the team to feedback. Also, it's very difficult in the setting where you have pre-hospital teams and hospital teams that don't talk to each other. Especially, I'm talking about event medicine, because you know, if it's regular EMS, there might be some, you know, governance processes. But often events, you have different teams, and then getting feedback from the hospital, which has a great educational value. And if I can add, also engaging the patient. So this case report was possible only because we were visited back by the patient, and they said, actually, I've been thinking about this case, but you know, for some time I didn't really had a way of getting in touch with him. And then I said, when I proposed the plan to him, he was enthusiastic, and he sent me access to all his medical files, including the consultation he had in other centers. And I actually had him review the manuscript. So I also consider, you know, there is way more and more patient engagement into scientific work, because patients have their unique insights, you know, into their own experiences. And it's the only perspective that, as a researcher, we should consider.
This is absolutely key. Not to stop you in your flow. This is absolutely key that we actually include patients within, where possible, within debriefs and within information sharing, and especially if it's a positive outcome, that actually we share learning with patients, and that it's patient-centered care fundamentally. So I just wanted to agree with that point. Could you speak to where you see this case informing future care? So we've just spoken about patient-centered care, but could you speak to ways in which we share learning with the wider team, where we also just how this informs your care for exercise-associated collapse? So how does this case sort of inform the way you treat future cases for maybe these more complex cases?
Well, first of all, you know, it keeps the team updated from a scientific perspectives, but also it allows us to reflect on our own internal procedures, which should be a robust approach to exercise-associated collapse supported by internationally validated algorithms. And this is all sort of things you can find published. But also, for me, is also in the case the patient goes to a different hospital, because as I said, I do not decide when I'm on the field to which hospitals the patient goes. It is important to actually interface with hospitals, because different emergency departments might not all be familiar with specific pathologies of, for say, endurance medicine. So it's possible that exercise-associated heat stroke is actually mistaken for a fever, which is sort of a things that should not happen. I've many times seen patients which were hyperthermic taken to the emergency department, and among the treatments, paracetamol was given. Now, if you want to give them paracetamol because they have cramps for the pain, that's fine. But if in your mind you're treating the temperature with a paracetamol, then that's actually in the guidelines. It's written that there is no pharmaceutical interventions which is working on exercise-associated heat stroke. So because these are pathologies which clinicians treating them on the field might be more interested, more experienced, I think it's also very important to try to engage and have the hospital on board that these pathologies have their own specific treatments that they might not see that often.
So just as we come in to land actually on the conversation, Luca, could you maybe speak to just sharing knowledge with the wider team? So you've written this fantastic case study out, and it's got some great learning points in it from information sharing, from voice of the patient, from actually a more nuanced and complex differential diagnosis, but really digging into all aspects of care, really. Could you maybe speak to what you'd like to see? Would you like to see more of this type of case study published, and indeed information sharing, to showcase other centres, or indeed your own centre, sharing more of these kind of nuanced cases to share learning with a wider audience?
Well, if I can be honest with you, my ideal world research paper would actually be more of a registry of exercise-associated heat stroke, because it's very difficult, it's very complicated, and everything we have is mostly based on either case series, but it's difficult to build a multicentric, international data registry of exercise-associated heat stroke with, interestingly, outcomes. Because we haven't really mentioned the fact that this patient did not have an exercise-associated heat stroke, but exercise-associated heat stroke is known to, or at least we are hypothesizing, that it can have long-term functional outcomes, which can be very, very subtle to identify. And to make a comparison, a bit like the concussion in rugby. So there are contact sports. You don't have validated scales to assess concussion on the field. And because we know concussion is a long-term problem, now we are wondering, is exercise-associated heat stroke, which can happen to episodes to some runners, a long-term problem also? Because you don't really notice that. Once you've cooled him off, most of the time the cognition is back. And, you know, at a first level neurological assessment, everything is fine. But is there anything more subtle ongoing? So that's, you know, more speculative thoughts, food for thoughts for the future.
Fantastic, Luca. Listen, thank you for your time today. I really do appreciate it. We'll put this paper in the show notes. And so please do read it in your own time, because it's an absolutely fascinating read. Thank you again.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to the episode. Please feel free to rate, review, and subscribe on whichever platform you're listening to. Please also head over to the World Extreme Medicine website, where you can find more engaging content on extreme medicine webinars and indeed the collection of courses from our global network, including humanitarian, disaster relief, expedition, space, military, tactical, and performance medicine. Thanks again.